This episode is sponsored by 5.11, a company that I've used for well over a decade and continue to use to this day. And 5.11 is offering you guys, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a discount on every purchase you make with them. Before we get to that code, I want to highlight a couple of products that, again, I personally use today. One of the most impressive products they just released is their Rush Backpack 2.0. Now, for many of you, whether you're going to the fire station, the police station, whether you're traveling with your family, whether you're taking training courses, we have to fly, we have to drive, we have to take trains. And I have to say, I own multiple backpacks, many of 5.11's different ones, but as far as a day pack, this one was the most impressive. There are so many different compartments. The way it sits on your back is incredibly comfortable. If you are a concealed carry person, there's also a spot for a weapon. So they've thought of multiple things that a man or woman would have to do on a daily basis. That is in addition to all of the products that I talk about a lot. Their uniforms, fit for men or fit for women in the first responder professions. The footwear that they offer, whether it's the Norris sneaker or the Atlas system that is designed for foot health and therefore knees and back and hips and shoulders and neck. As a civilian, I live in a lot of their clothes as well. Their jeans stretch. You can actually squat down in them. We live in Florida here, so I wear a lot of their shorts, which again, very, very lightweight material. You can get it wet and it will dry almost immediately. And then moving to the fitness and tactical space, I used to have just a regular weight vest. Recently, I switched to a 5.11 vest and actually bought ballistic plates as well. My thinking was simply, if I'm going to have a vest, why not have one that protects me as well? And that TAC vest is trusted by law enforcement all around the country. So I mentioned they were going to offer you a discount code. So if you go to 5.11tactical.com and enter the code SHIELD15, SHIELD15, you'll get 15% off, not just that one purchase, but every time you visit their store. And if you want to learn more about 5.11, their mission, their products, then listen to episode 338 of the Behind the Shield podcast with the CEO and founder, Francisco Morales. Welcome to episode 600 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week I have an incredible human being. Every time we hit a benchmark number, none of my guests are more important than the other. However, I try to find something extra special for each of these big number episodes. So Nick Hall was 8 years old when a murderer burst into his family's home, shot one of his relatives, and held the rest of his family hostage for 50 hours. During that SWAT standoff, there was a tragic miscommunication and a sniper took a shot at what he thought was the intruder, but it was actually Nick's mother, one of the hostages. Now, for many people, that would send them down a dark path, maybe an anti-police feeling, but ultimately, Nick overcame his trauma and became a police officer himself to be part of the solution. So I cannot tell you how powerful this conversation is. We talk about Nick's early life. We talked about some of the lows that he did find himself, how he entered law enforcement, community policing, and so much more. Before we get to this incredible episode, as I say every week, please just take a moment, go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of now 600 episodes. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person that needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Nick Hall. Enjoy. Well, Nick, I want to start by saying thank you so much for welcoming me into your beautiful home today.
Oh, thank you, man.
So for people listening, where roughly on planet Earth are we sitting?
We're in Central Florida by the beach.
Fantastic. So I was connected with you by Doug Munda. This is actually going to be episode 600. After he told me your story, I kind of try and make, not that there are any more important than the other ones, but there's kind of like a landmark episode. You have such an incredible story, so I'm honored that you trust me to sit here today.
Well, no pressure, man. I told him before, like when he told me who you were, I was like, oh, I listened to the podcast and I follow you on Instagram, and I was looking on your post. I'm like, oh man, I wonder who's 600. And like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I put a post up. Who's going to be episode 600? Wrong answers only. And it's been hilarious.
I should have put my name. I would have.
There we go. So now you know. All right. So I would love to start at the very beginning. So tell me where you were born, and then tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, and how many siblings.
Okay. So I was born in New York. I have a brother and a sister. I'm the middle one. I was born in Long Island in the, I almost forgot where I was born, in 92. I'm turning 30 this year. My parents, they separated before I was born, actually, and my dad ended up moving down to Florida with my older brother. And I grew up in New York for a little bit till I was about 8 with my sister. And then we moved down to Orlando when I was 8, and then, you know, the big incident happened. And I ended up living with my dad after that, and I've been down here in Florida ever since.
So obviously the incident is involving the city of Orlando itself. Talk to me about life in New York as you remember it, and then talk to me about your mom.
So I remember it's kind of like bits and pieces now. Like I remember, you know, snow, those moments. And there was a little bit of a time where we have family in Jamaica, and I stayed in Jamaica for a bit too. So I remember living, my grandma has a big old property. I remember like chasing goats and chickens and stuff. And New York, I mean, it's what you would imagine a 6-year-old could remember. This big city, you know. So not too much memories there, but I did have a lot of cousins. I had like 14, 15 aunts and uncles. So there was always...
Wow.
Yeah. So, all on my mom's side. So there was always somebody to play with up there.
So your mom was Andrea. So tell me again, the woman that you remember, and also, you know, things that you've learned ever since.
So growing up, you know, my mom, it was always like, you know, us, because I didn't really remember my dad at that point. She'd always make sure we had somewhere to stay. You know, we weren't, I wouldn't say we weren't poor, but like we weren't too well off, you know, kind of looking back on things. We'd always live with an aunt or an uncle, stay somewhere, you know. There was a she's quiet woman, but there was times where I earned an ass whooping. And, and there was a specific one where I remember I'd gotten some Pokemon cards, and she was like, I was going to go out and try to trade them. And she knew before I left the apartment, she's like, don't go trade them. They might be worth something one day. And I'm like, yeah, it's fine, I'll go. And traded them, come back in. She asked me, and I don't know where I learned the word from, but she was like, did you trade them? And I said, I didn't fucking trade. And next thing I know, I'm running around like a one-bedroom apartment trying not to catch a whooping. And it still happened. But yeah, quiet, but she was good with a wooden spoon.
Now, she's obviously raising, you know, multiple children. Was there any kind of professional career side at that point, or was she solely just trying to raise all of you?
From what I remember, she was working at Macy's, a department store, and it was, you know, she'd work there. There were some days I'd go there, and I was a little asshole, man. There was shirts that had like toy cars in them. And I'd take the toy cards out. I'm like, hey, look, I found these, you know? And I remember playing like the video game demos, like just all day, just making the time pass. Looking back, I don't know how long I was in the
store. I was going to say.
But I just remember always being there for a while, you know?
So you moved down from New York to Orlando. So, I mean, you know, sometimes there's time to kind of build up to like certain specific events in people's lives, but yours just happened very, very early. So talk to me about July 23rd, 2000.
So, in that summer, me, my mom, and my sister, she wasn't even one yet. We moved down to Orlando, and we go to my aunt's house. That weekend, that day is actually my brother's birthday. knowing now they were supposed to, my brother was supposed to come over. We were going to see him that weekend. It was a Saturday morning. I remember watching cartoons, and I just start hearing like a loud bang on the door, and I look, it's a random old white guy with a gun in his hand, and he came in. I see him. He ends up shooting my cousin in the. From what I saw, it looked like he shot him in the mouth. I think it ended up going through like his spine. Like he didn't die. Cousin's alive and well to this day. I remember seeing like all the blood everywhere in like the bathroom, and he lets my cousin leave. So my cousin goes outside. But background on this guy, he was on the run from the cops. He's a what we would call a piece of shit. He ended up going to prison before for, I think, something. It was either Bat Leo. I don't really remember too much. Or he ended up it was a murder or something. He gets out early. He is down Pompano Beach area. He robs a convenience store, kills the clerk. He's on the run from the cops. He gets up to Orange County. I believe the cops try to pull him over. He ends up shooting a deputy. And they're just fleeing. He's fleeing, and he ends up going to our house. And the garage door was open at the time, so he just took that opportunity upon himself to come in, and next thing you know, we're being held hostage.
So at the time, you know, your mom was there, obviously. You said your cousin was there and was shot and was able to get out. But you had other siblings in there too.
Yeah, so it's my aunt's house, so it's her. Her kids, was my cousin that got shot, and my other cousins. And my other cousin has a kid the same age as, it's like my, what is that, like a great cousin? I just call her my cousin.
Yeah, it gets so complicated. Yeah.
So it's two babies, two adults, and then teenagers and me. So it's a bit of a full house at the time.
Now that becomes a hostage situation. So again, you know, you feel free to kind of fuse what you remember and what you were told, obviously, much later. You know, they burst through a door. You see your cousin shot, which it must be, you know, a horrendously traumatic experience, just singularly. Explain how that then became a hostage situation.
So he ends up, that happens. And next thing you know, the standoff, it lasts 50 hours. We're in the house. He's barricaded with us for 50 hours. He starts making demands towards the end, like, you know, the SWAT team, negotiation team, they wanted to bring us food and stuff. And it's like, while we're in there, he ends up, like, moving us from different bedrooms. And there was a time where it's, like, one of those moments that you remember, like, a traumatic sense, like, you know, a smell or a touch or something. He points the gun. He puts the gun in the back of my head, like, as we're, like, walking. And, like, to this day, I mean, I work with guns now, but to this day, it was, like, the coldest gun I ever felt. Like, it felt like you put a gun in a freezer, and then you touch it. I just remember feeling it on the back of my head as we were walking from, he had us all, we were all in one bedroom, and then he put us all in the master bedroom, like the master bedroom closet. And from that point on in the master bedroom closet, I remember, like, just waking up, sleeping, you know, like, I don't know what time frame it is, but it was like one of those moments where I remember, like, very, like, okay, this is the first time I ever prayed, it felt like. Like, I still remember the prayer. I'm like, hey, God, like, if you're there, like, just help us, you know, get us out of this kind of thing. And towards the end, the SWAT team, they wanted to bring us food. I think it was donuts. And he told me to go get the donuts. And I remember saying no. And I told my mom to go get it. So when she went to go get the food, I just remember hearing gunshots. And shortly after, he takes me, and I'm holding my sister. He covers my head, so I don't see anything in the house. He escorts me out. I remember they took my sister into an ambulance, check on her. Looking back now, I would say probably like where they had a command post or something. They took me somewhere else, and I just remember asking, like, I'm like, where's my mom? Where's my mom? And some lady told me that she had died. So.
God. So when you were in that whole hostage situation, do you have any memories or recollections of the adults trying to keep you calm? Because, I mean, that must be terrifying for a child, and it must be terrifying for a parent, because I would be so damn scared if it was on my own. But to have my child in that situation, I can't imagine how horrendous that must have been for the adults.
Not really. I mean, I remember, like, I just remember, you know, always being, like, close to my mom, like, she was near somewhere. I don't remember too many, like, conversations. I just remember, you know, seeing my cousin get shot, and then another one of my cousins, when she had came out of her room, I remember the suspect talking, and looking back, he was in a mental state that, with the training I have now, I know it wasn't going to end with him being alive. He was going to kill himself or something. I remember him, you know, like, kind of paranoid as to, like, how many people were in the house, but I don't remember much of, like, you know, like, my mom talking to me or anything. I just remember really going in and out of sleep. I remember peeing myself. Did that.
Oh, sure.
did that once, just sleeping in the closet, just constantly waking up, falling asleep, like, you know, hearing noise and not hearing noise, and, like, just losing a track of time, like, not knowing what time it is, what day it is, if it's day or night, you know?
So you had that kind of experience as an 8-year-old boy. Obviously, there's another entire lens to that situation through the law enforcement lens of that incident. So kind of walk me through, you know, what you've heard of the police response to that event, and then how that unfolded in tragedy from their end.
So unfortunately, a SWAT sniper ended up shooting my mother, thinking she was a suspect. And initially, that area where my aunt lives is a county jurisdiction. So it was Orange County SWAT team that was there at first. And I don't know the numbers of, like, how many they had on the team at the time back then, but it was smaller than it is now. And so they asked for relief from OPD. And I think the basic changing of information between the two teams was we have a house full of you know, African Americans with a white male suspect. But the only issue is I'm the only dark one in the house. Everybody is light skinned. So I think when she went to the door by the garage, they didn't see her face. I think they just saw, like, an arm, light colored, you know, like light colored hand or something, and they ended up shooting through the door, ended up striking my mom.
Now, one of my OPD friends had said, from what he was told, that the shooter had also put his clothes on your mom. Is that right?
I'm not sure on that.
Okay. Yeah. That might be a new perspective then.
I know there's, well, I haven't done it yet, but there's, I would like to, like, you know, look at the case report on it and the debrief on that.
Yeah. Because I asked him, you know, as you know, some agencies don't play well together. And I worked in Orange County. Meadowwoods was actually my second due. So one station area south of where I worked. And we would also do a lot of the stuff where we'd follow the Bearcat on the SWAT calls. So I'm familiar with the county, I'm familiar with the SWAT team. And so I said, oh, you know, was there good communication between the agency? And he said, well, looking back, the fact that they called OPD when it's actually closer to another county's jurisdiction tells me that actually, yes, they did. It was just, you know, not just, but where the failure was the communication. And that one, like you said, that lack of detailed description caused that one, you know, horrendous decision.
Yeah.
So walk me through, as an 8-year-old boy, I mean, the event itself is horrific and you know, that's an acute trauma, but now you don't have your mother. So, you know, what were the next years like for you, you know, and your family dynamic?
So the next year I ended up still living with my aunt. I go to school in Orange County. Third grade, you know, I remember there was times where, like, I'm just crying in class, having, like, a tantrum or whatever. And I stayed there for over a year. And after that, I come to Brevard County, end up living with my dad and my brother and stepmom. And for most of like my younger childhood, I kind of felt like it was my fault that everything had happened, because I remembered like leaving the garage door open. So I had a hard time thinking like if I just left the garage door closed, you know, none of this would have happened. And my stepmom kind of like helped me get through all of that. You know, they tried to put me in therapy and stuff like that, but I don't remember that ever working. Then growing up with my stepmom and then starting to kind of learn about God and having, you know, a relationship with God, it was kind of like understanding everything happens for a reason. You know, there's a higher power. Like, there's a reason why this happened, you know? So that kind of helps me get through it at a young age.
Now, had that happened, say, a year and a half ago, obviously, you know, it would have immense media exposure. What was that element? What was that response to the story?
So I know you'd have to ask my cousins about like how the media took it, because I mean you can find it, like there were news articles about it, but it didn't. I think information travels a whole lot faster now, and people are more quick to choose to be upset about certain things. Like if it were to happen now, I mean it would have been one of those things you see on like CNN every day. And like, you know, you got a white cop shoots black woman unarmed, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely. You have Al Sharpton at your house for the next two weeks.
I mean, Johnny Cochran was actually on the case. I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I didn't know that until I got older. I'm like, I don't know who Johnny Cochran is, you know.
Was he part of the OJ case?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He was the whole, if the glove fits, if the glove don't, yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah. PR in law. all right. Well, then I kind of want to get obviously to your journey to, you know, the career that you chose. And I think that's what makes it such a powerful story. I mean, amongst so many other areas, but I want to kind of lay out the rest of your kind of childhood. So what about sports? You know, what were you playing? Cause you know, you ended up in a very physically demanding profession. Were you doing any sporting events or training in a certain way that ultimately, unbeknownst to you, would set you up for that?
I mean, I played like JV football for a little bit, but you know, back then that didn't help. The main thing, working construction, I guess it's kind of a workout, like functional fitness. And so after high school, I'll probably give you the timeline here. So, you know, after high school, I turn 18, I graduate. I start finding out, you know, my dad's having an affair. He was with my stepmom for, like I said, before I was born, my parents separated. So, you know, over a majority of my lifetime. And when I came here, she just felt like another mom to me. And so I was a mama's boy growing up. So it was kind of easy to continue to being a mama's boy. Find out he's having an affair with some lady in a different country. And I'm just hearing my parents, you know, fight every night. He's leaving angry. She's sitting there crying, find out what's happening. And I just start losing respect for him. Anytime they would go out of town, I'd have friends over smoking weed, partying, you know, doing whatever. One day they come back early and they see the house is trashed. So, you know, I didn't want to come home. And my dad's like, if you don't call me back today, don't bother coming home. So I was like, okay. Like, I already lost respect for him. Didn't want to live with him. Didn't know how to say, I don't want to live here anymore. You know, it's kind of the way he raised me and my brother, it's like one of those mega authoritarian kind of deal where the parent always says this, you do it, you don't.
Do what I say, not as I do.
Yeah, yeah. That, like, your feelings, don't care about it. This is a task, do complete, you know. Which, come learning that doesn't work with my 6-year-old. Like, I'm learning these kids have emotions you got to deal with at a young age.
So, yes, there's no manual.
Yeah. So, so after that happens, you know, I'm homeless, living in my car. I'm in the Orlando area. Figure I could crash at, you know, some of my friends' houses that are in college while I'm not at the moment. And that lasts for maybe a couple months, not too much. You know, I tried panhandling. I wasn't too good at it. I'm like a 18-year-old kid I remember telling people, I'm like, hey, I know it doesn't look like it, but I'm homeless. Do you have any money? And I'm like trying to stretch McDonald's value menus for like a week. Like, I remember when I was staying with my friend, I bought maybe like 10 McDoubles, and I thought I could like have one a day. After like the sixth day, it was like, okay, I don't think this is good for me. So.
But they probably looked exactly the same as when you bought them.
Yeah, yeah. I probably didn't need to put them in the fridge. You just leave them there.
Yeah, leave them on the top of the dash.
So and after couch surfing, my girlfriend, it's my wife now, her, in the meantime of this, she's living over here, driving over there, like giving me money anytime she can. She's 16, 17, working at an ice cream place. And she's just, I mean, looking back, man, we were dumb, like, but grateful. Like, she was solid. So she asked her parents if I could stay with them. And they're like, okay, you can stay here for a week, then you need to figure something out. And during that week, my dad comes by. He has all of my shit packed. And this isn't the time he had all my shit packed. This is the time before we get there. He gets there. He's like, hey, come on home. Like, stop, you know, doing your bullshit. And I'm like, I don't want to live with you anymore, you know? And we have an argument. He's saying, I wish you were dead instead of your mom. And then he tells me that he's not even my real dad. And I'm like, okay, whatever. He leaves. So he says that. I'm like, all right, let me fact check this. I call one of my many aunts. And I'm like, hey, my dad said he's not my real dad. Is that true? And she goes, yeah, I was waiting for somebody to tell you. I'm like, oh, okay. So, you know, then I double down and I check with all my other aunts that, you know, live down here, try to verify. And sure enough, he's not my real dad. He just ended up signing the birth certificate to help my mom out at the time because she was single. And actually this past, I want to say, what, maybe 2 years ago now, I finally got in contact with my real dad. So one of my aunts had his info. Like, it's just waiting for me to ask for it at some point. And I ended up getting his info, and I talked to him on the phone. And the background on that, he was an insurance agent in New York. He sold one of my aunt's insurance, and he met my mom, sold her insurance, one night stand. And he was actually married at the time, so I could see why I ended up being another family secret.
Mm-hmm.
So on top of, you know, having a dad that I thought was my dad, basically kind of being a POS, and my real dad is not so much better. So it was kind of like, wow, double whammy. So
now, was there any kind of acute impact from that? Because you have already, you know, a huge amount of trauma. Like you said, you tried counseling, didn't feel like it worked. And of course, you're so young, you know, it's hard to process that. But now some of the stability that you'd known that you'd led into was not only taken away, but it was actually kind of thrown in your face. Especially, I mean, God, to say, you know, I wish you died instead of your mom. I can't think of anything worse you could say to a child that lost their parent. So did you kind of, when you look back now, experience a kind of impact from that secondary trauma then?
Yeah, I mean, there was the saying is like the most influential parent, the same sex parent, you know, kind of thing. So definitely having, you know, no real like good genuine father figure, it affected me young. But luckily, with me and my wife, we were together, I mean, pretty much like my whole adult life. Her dad, I mean, he taught me everything I know, everything like a man should know. It was him changing oil, you know, changing tire, doing all that stuff. So it was kind of like there's that gap of not having something to look up to. So it ends up making you make, you know, bad decisions. Like all the bullshit decisions and stupid friends I was hanging out with, looking back and analyzing, it's like, you didn't really have, you know, a good background of like what a good father should have been raising his kids.
Mm-hmm.
But
what good friends should look like.
Yeah. And like people that know me, they know, like, because my dad, he was a retired cop. And then got into like real estate when the market was good down here. So upper middle class. So, you know, they kind of just, they were living in a subdivision. So it just looked like I was a rich kid at the time. But it was one of those things where you could get whatever you want, but there still felt like there was something lacking. Like when I look back and think about my relationship with him and his relationship with my older brother, who's 5 years older at the time, it was like, I could see there's weird things that he would, you know, do with my brother, but there's things that I wouldn't really have much of a relationship. So my relationship was stronger with my stepmom. And then kind of seeing all that go down was like, it made me lose more respect for my dad, if anything.
Now, with him being in the law enforcement profession and retiring, and, you know, we're all very, very aware of, you know, the cost of the job.
Yeah.
When you look back, were there any elements of what we might call PTSD, or maybe, you know, other areas of his life that manifested when he was parenting you?
I mean, could have been, I know he did, I think he did like 10 years NYPD. And I think, I don't know, he never talked about any like traumatic things. I mean, he was an agent, did undercover stuff. But I think when it comes down to it, it's just the breaking down of like learning how to communicate with different people, you know, like the way we talk to people at work. That's not the way you can like talk to your family at home.
No, like, definitely not.
Like, there's times where like I'll say something and I've learned to like emotionally detach from things to analyze it, and I'll say something like that to her, and she's like, "You're not at work, bud. Like, don't. You're talking to me like you're a cop. Don't do that." So,
well, so speaking of that, then, when you were, let's say, high school age, you know, you talked about going into construction, but what was your dream profession then? Did you have anything that you were hoping to become?
So high school, I really got into like graphic design. I was like computer nerd. I did like computer classes like 3 years. And my dad, it was a straight dream killer, man. Like, I remember saying, "Hey, I want to do this." And it was like, "Well, that doesn't make any money. That's stupid. Don't do that," you know? And like looking back, having a kid now, it's like the money's not the end game, because you're going to keep chasing it, and then that's all you're going to have, and then what, you know? So that really, I was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I just know they told me I got to go to college or I'm going to get kicked out. So I went to the community college down the street, and I don't even remember what I was studying, and I was just taking classes, but my friends would tell you now, I was barely there. Like, one thing I would tell kids now, just finish school, get it all done, because I was back in college, then I switched agencies, now I'm readmitting again. I'm like, just do it when you graduate, get it done and over with, because it's a whole lot harder to study when you have a career and a family and bills.
Absolutely.
It's easier to just do it when you got someone else paying for your shit.
Well, especially when you're trying to redo math and English and you've forgotten 95% because you're, you know, 20 years out of school. I tell you that from experience. And also, you end up being the kind of weird old guy in the back of the hall, which is makes you self-conscious. Yeah. All right. Well, then again, had this come out a year ago, you know, there would be all these pigeonholes of this scene of, oh, this person was this color and this person was of this background. I think, you know, one side would definitely paint a very kind of anti-law enforcement rhetoric to your story. And then it's a tragic story. You found yourself entering the very profession that, you know, on paper had taken your mother from you, even though obviously it's a lot more complicated than that, and that person was trying to protect you. So walk me through when you graduated, you know, which professions you found yourself in, and then let's go to what made you choose policing.
So after graduating high school and then the whole, you know, getting kicked out, being homeless thing, I lived with my wife's family, or girlfriend at the time. Stayed there for a year, then we got on our feet, got a duplex, and my very first job was just working at Kohl's, and I was just, you know, moving freight in the back. I'm like, okay, like, I need to do something else. So I started working with her dad in construction, And it helped me start to learn like core values, you know, like people, even if your job is a shitty job and it sucks, people still need you to finish your job so they can do their job and the whole thing gets done. So it made me appreciate, you know, hard work and putting in good work, you know, like people won't know who you are. They just see your work. Like you can, no one's ever really going to remember your name too much. They just know what you do. So that really like helped mold me into where I am now. And it was fun, but you know, shoveling concrete in the Florida heat, it got annoying. Like after a couple of years, I was like, okay, I need to do something that is, I can have a career in that can have benefits, health insurance, you know? So I was thinking like, all right, I want to do something that helps people. And, I want to do something that, you know, makes me feel good about myself kind of deal. So I'm like doing the right thing, helping people, you know, firefighter could be that. Then I realized, you know, getting on a ladder is not, that's not my thing. Like
we were talking that before we recorded. Yeah. So not big a fan of heights.
No, like even like putting up Christmas lights, man, I think this is the first year living here after, you know, almost 10 years. I got on the roof to put up the lights on the second gable up there. Because normally my father-in-law would come do it, and I'm like, dude, you're doing it until you die. So after realizing I wasn't going to be a firefighter, I'm like, okay, next best thing, you know, being a cop. And my incident that happened with my family, it gave me, like, that big perspective of this is something that can happen, you know? Like, are you mentally prepared for this? Like, how would you handle that? And there's that saying, you know, they say, if not me, then who? If not now, then when? You know? So it's definitely one of those ones where I was like, all right, like I'd rather it be me to go in instead of just, you know, watching all this stuff on the news about, you know, the incidents with cops, you know, if they shoot the wrong person or if something happens. I didn't want to be one of those that's just sitting on the phone, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking it. I'm like, all right, I want to go in and do it, you know?
Beautiful. Now, up to that point, had you experienced anti-law enforcement, you know, messaging from family members or whoever it was that would sway you the other way? Because I mean, you'd think it would be natural, you know, I mean, the same way as people, even let's take it from a racial point of view. Oh, I don't like, you know, group of people X. Oh, because I was mugged by someone once. It's like, oh, that's not the whole freaking race that mugged you,
yeah.
You know, but you see the same with law enforcement where, you know, the uniform is a uniform. And as you and I know, you know, there are phenomenal human beings wearing uniforms and occasionally, you know, pieces of shit.
Yeah. I know there was, I mean, it's like what my dad and my stepmom at the time, they were a little ignorant. There was a lot of times, you know, where like, yes, racism exists, but to constantly, you know, hear your parents say, I didn't get this or this didn't happen because we were black. And it was like, okay, there's no way like every bad thing that happens to you is because of race. So, and then living down here, you know, my dad being from New York, and they think everybody from the South is racist. So it was always, oh, there's racist cops everywhere, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you can keep saying it, but you don't actually know, you know? So when I told at the time when I knew I wanted to get into law enforcement, I didn't have a open relationship talking to my dad and stepmom after finding out the whole, you know, he's not my real dad thing. So I told my family on my mom's side about it, and I told them why, and they respected the decision, you know? Like our family, luckily, I think being Jamaican, being immigrants, it's like we're not too caught up in all the bullshit that's happening in America right now. And so I think it made it easier. It wasn't a hard conversation. They respected it. They knew. I told them why I wanted to do it, and they believed in me. So I think that helped give me the confidence I need to, you know, get a foot in the door.
Well, it's an interesting point you touched on as well, because I feel that's the lens that I have coming from England to here. Doesn't mean that my opinion is, you know, worth any more than anyone else's, but your perspective is different. Yeah. When you're not born and bred with a certain narrative, you kind of walk into the room and that narrative's there, and some elements of it might be valid, but some elements aren't. And it's very weird then when you start hearing, and in, perfect example, take race out of it, the COVID thing, you know, like we went from no one talking about immunization or, you know, really conspiracies or any of the other extremist conversations that we heard to all of a sudden pick a side, you know, and, you know, either you're, if you're not wearing a mask, you're a mass murderer, or if you are wearing a mask, then clearly you're a conspiracy theorist, you know, sheeple, whatever, you know, and it's like, what happened? But when you walk into that room from the outside, you're like, hey, do you realize you've both lost your fucking minds? Like the middle ground, for example, in that thing is we need to make everyone healthier. So whatever we're exposed to, you know, you got a better chance of, you know, surviving. If there's tools like, you know, the real actually fitted masks or vaccinations, then absolutely use them. But also not everyone needs to have them. But yeah, and then I saw that like people became in such like airtight silos that they weren't willing to accept anything from the outside. And it was terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the, I mean, I think growing up with what I went through and then the job I have, it gives you, you meet a lot of people, a lot of different people from different backgrounds, and you got to have an open mind and like just take in new information and learn from it, you know? And definitely like me and my wife, we had COVID, and I'm not vaccinated, and that got to a point where I was like, damn, this shit hurts. Like I ended up getting pneumonia after it, and I was like, okay, like I know I don't really want to get vaccinated, but let me do some research as to like how to be healthier, you know, because most of the time I was looking at stuff and it's like you don't see a lot of sick like vegans or whatever. I mean, we had friends that were vegan, and it's just like if you eat better, you live better, you know. So I'm thinking, let me try to eat better, not eat as much, you know, shit food, and try to eat better food, eat, you know, fresh meat, you know, kind of started doing the whole, finding, you know, local markets, getting better beef, no hormones and steroids and all that stuff, just to kind of feel better. Cause I'd rather do that, try that first. And if that doesn't work, then okay, then I'll research and then maybe, you know, get some random needle stuck in me. But at the moment, I'm going to try this and see how that goes. And so far, you know, so far it's going good. You know?
Absolutely. And I think that's it. Every person, exactly what you said, they get all the right information and then they make an informed decision for they themselves. Like, you know, someone living in rural Montana on a ranch has a different environmental exposure than someone living 27 floors up in New York City. You know, but it was like tarring everyone with the same brush. And for those two, both of them, the middle message is health. And, you know, the ranch hand in Montana is probably eating well, probably getting a lot of exercise, daylight, fresh air, you know, time on their own to basically be present. And then conversely, the person in Manhattan is probably overstressed, maybe eating shitty food, maybe stuck in a office for, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, you know. So those were the conversations that weren't being had. And it was the same with, you know, we'll get into this, but with, you know, some of the defund and, you know, all these discussions was absolutely, there are times, and you and I both know this, we've been on scenes where it wasn't handled the way it's supposed to be handled, but we have to find the common denominators and improve the prevention element rather than just burn the whole thing down.
Yeah. I mean, you can see it here, man. We went plant crazy. I'm trying to get my garden going. This like that thing there is that's a whole passion fruit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It had one last year, but it broke and died on me. So definitely wanting to, you know, hopefully in the future get some land and have my own farm, you know, kind of just eat fresh and try to live as long as I can, you know, enjoy life.
Absolutely. Well, and we'll get into it now, but like our profession as well. I mean, you know, we're up against, especially you. Yeah, you know, we at least have stations that we can move around in and exercise.
I like to say I was a good amount of fat for getting COVID, because like, you know, it took off a couple pounds, but like I didn't end up dying. You know, like mm-hmm. I was still healthy enough. I was just fat, so I was like, all right, I'll take that and I'll live. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. If people got it and it kicked their ass a bit, then that's a wake up call as well. Not in a bad way, you know, but that's what we should get out of these incidents is that, okay, this is an opportunity for us to grow and learn and make ourselves better.
Yeah.
Versus we just argue about these extreme issues, vaccines, ivermectin, whatever you want, and no one actually learns anything. And then we go back to the same freaking thing we were doing 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me then about your journey into law enforcement. You had, your dad, you knew had been a cop, but you hadn't got that actively in your life. Was it an easy path for you? Was it a rocky road?
Getting into it, I think it was, I would say easy, because like I said, it gave me that perspective that most people probably don't think about when they're thinking about wanting to be a cop. And I'm like, okay, well, here's my real life issue that I had with it. So I know this can happen, And I remember when I first got in, when I was working construction, I had dreads at the time. So I go into the police academy trying to, apply, and they're like, well, you got to cut those. And I'm like, done, let's go. So when I was going through it at the time, I ended up, I tried reaching out to my dad about it, and that relationship was still kind of strained because he, it felt like I was owed an apology, and it was pulling teeth trying to get him to admit he shouldn't have said, I wish you were dead instead of your mom. And eventually that conversation happened, but it was still strained. And but once I got into law enforcement, the first place I got to is actually, let me backtrack. So the first place I applied to was when I met Doug Mondo when I worked at COCO. I applied there first. They had a reserve spot. They didn't have a paid position yet. So when a sergeant was going to retire, I would have filled that position. So basically reserve is you're working there, but you're not getting paid. And, my wife's pregnant at the time. So I'm kind of like, I'll take it because it took me 8 months to finally get, an offer. But I'd rather get paid for this. So halfway through the process with them, I get offered another spot in a smaller town south of here. And they offered me the job on the spot at the interview. So I called Coco back. I'm like, hey, I'm going to go work over here. And they're like, where? I'm like, here. And they're like, okay, good luck. So I get there. And the first stint, man, I was overthinking everything, dude. It was just any basic stuff. I'm just, fumble fucking around with stuff, just forgetting certain things. I'm overanalyzing certain things, which makes my officer safety look rough. So long story short, I washed out of the field training there. And I remember the chief, I'm still friends with the chief. Now he's a great guy. He, I remember when he told me, he's like, hey, in the exit interview, maybe you should look at, working at a jail, starting from there. And, came home here and I was reassessing. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. This is still what I want to do. So Coco was still hiring. I reapplied. Lieutenant called me back. He's like, hey, what happened down there? And I was like, well, this is what happened. I told him my issues and why they're happening. He was like, oh, that'll wash out in field training. Hired me. I go through Coco, field training, all those issues were gone. I wouldn't say it was the place. It was just the person. It was me. I just had to relax and remember, be yourself. I was too thinking, I'm a cop. This is the badge. I gotta be this. No, man, you're just a city worker, man. And I breached through it there, and I think working there, you kind of learn a lot about the community. It's it has its rough areas and its good areas, and I think I grew there. I liked it. I learned a lot about myself going there.
So with that burning why that you had as far as being the best police officer you could be to try and prevent a tragedy happening, and even though, again, I'm not putting blame on the sniper solely by any means, but trying to be a positive force, against something like that happening again, what did that look like on your ownership, on your training, on your kind of journey, your the seriousness of which you took your specific job?
It gave me those career goals of, you know, wanting to be on SWAT and wanting to be a sniper. It's still on the list of things to do. And so, like, anytime if there's a call that was like, okay, like, we got to go in the fray, you know, there's a fight in progress, a shooting or something, it gives you that, like, all right, like, you know, your perspective, that's the fire, like, that's the structure fire, you go in it, you know. So it was always like, this is it, like, these are the moments that this is what you wanted to do, and this, and here it is, so go do it, you know. So it definitely kind of gave me that work why, like you were saying, like, here's your why. You wanted to be here for this situation, and this is what you got, so go handle it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the root causes of some of the things you started seeing when you were wearing the uniform? Because one thing I like to do on here is just reverse engineer anything. And, you know, obviously we don't arrive on these scenes from a legal standpoint if we're responding as, you know, fire and EMS. But I tell people a lot, the responder's perspective, the law enforcement's perspective is so important, yet there's very, very few voices out there. Like I tell people, I can name a bunch of Army Rangers and Navy SEALs that are very well known, that have written books, but cops and firefighters and medics, unless you're in our circle, I know books written by, you know, people, but I mean, as far as giving that lens to the general public, it's invaluable and it's almost unheard. So when you started getting out there, you know, what were you seeing as some of the root causes for some of the, whether it was violence, crime, that you were seeing in the jurisdictions that you worked?
I mean, the main thing was the gang violence you would see up there, and like the innocent people that it would affect, the bystanders, the victims. And it was like, and knowing now, I tell people, if you're going to be the victim of a crime by a gang member, that gang member is a teenager, you know? It's never someone old, especially in this area. It's always someone young, and it's hard for a regular person to look at a 16, 17-year-old and think, oh, man, look, that guy's going to kill me for my car, or just kill me just to, you know, just to get some views on social media, just to be somebody. And it made me kind of worry more about our youth in the future. Like the old people you see, I don't think you can change an adult. You know, they are who they are. I can try to give them a speech, you know, like, hey, this is what happened to me, you can change. But if you're 50 years old, you know, you've made that decision, and this is just the time in my life where I meet you and you meet me, and, you know, we go our separate ways. I can't affect you as much as I can affect a teenager that thinks, growing up in the hood and seeing his older brother be a gang member, thinking that this is his only way out because his brother makes a whole bunch of money selling dope. So that's one thing I liked about working there. I could kind of talk to kids more and try to get them out. I know there was, I don't remember their name, but a dispatcher had called me one time, and she was like, hey, there was a family you met one time, and he spoke to the mom and the son. The mom wanted to call back and say, you know, thanks for talking to my kid. He ended up joining the military. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, it made a difference there. So, and I think that was one of the big things for me, was just seeing basically kids committing, you know, violent felony crimes, killing people, you know, selling drugs, shooting. It could take a toll on you.
Absolutely. Well, one of the root causes I see over and over again, and I talk about this all the time, and I'm sure some people get sick of it, but I'm not going to stop talking about it till it's fixed. But for me, through the medic / firefighter's eyes, the ripple effect of drug prohibition. So, you know, the sending addicts to the underworld, empowering the underworld to be able to sell, to be able to smuggle, all that stuff. You know, what that's done for the addicts and in prostitution and all these areas. That to me is a very strong root cause that I see, even in, you know, the poorer areas that keeps them poor. You know, they're basically profiting off the death of their community. So with your areas, you know, what was the impact of the drug side of what you were seeing?
I mean, same thing there. You would see like the progression of people when they go from maybe just like a drunk homeless bum to, you know, slowly going down the road of being a crackhead, and then next thing you know, you see them overdose for the last time, and it's like you see it coming, you just don't know when, you know. And in the beginning, it's like it's shocking new information, you know, you're not used to seeing like people die like that, but then you start to see it a lot, and sadly it's something you get numb to, you know. Like, I mean, how many times you go to a call and you see somebody shooting up, and you got a Narcan and bring them back, and then you bring them back, they don't want to go to the hospital, they just want to leave, and it's like, if you leave, you're going to die in like 10 minutes, bud. And it's you see families get torn apart from it, and there's like not much we can do on our end, you know. We just bring them back, but it's only just another timetable until they do it again. And I remember seeing like where they get their forgetting the name of the drug for it, when they get their the meds
for opiate overdose.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I know exactly what you're talking about. It just fell out of my head too.
I'm not a drug cop anymore, man.
Methadone.
Yeah, the methadone clinic. Okay. When they go to the methadone clinic, I remember the first time I saw the methadone clinic, I'm like heading home night shift. I see a line at 6 a.m., you know, like 50 people in line, methadone clinic, go get it. And they're back out the next day doing the same thing. And it's like, it's definitely one of those things where, you know, still kind of young, but starting to learn how drugs were handled in the past in this country, like in the 90s, you know, the whole the war on drugs and all that stuff. And then you see that it's more of a money-making thing. No one really cares about people that are addicted as long as they can make money off of it. The money is like, it's the thing that keeps everything going. You know, like I've seen, my wife, she likes to watch all them documentaries, and I get roped in on it, and I'm like, oh wow, my, that explains that. Like, no one really cares about helping people. As long as money's moving, it's going somewhere, and someone's getting rich, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, I do completely, and this is what I talk about a lot, and it all comes from you and I see it. Like, I tell people, like, we get to pull the curtain back on The Wizard of Oz, you know what I mean? We see what's really going on. And, you know, we talked about health. So, for example, the, you know, Fire EMS and PD as well get to see that very, very overweight people with a bag of meds that we were told would reduce their cholesterol, their blood pressure, their, you know, arrhythmias, and they still die at 40, 50, whatever it was, you know. And then there's the war on drugs and the dude with his frying pan and the egg, and, you know, and no, our streets are horrendous. And yeah, there are some, say, I'm sure if we, you know, you're a cop in Windermere, your view would be very different than some of the places that you and I have worked. But the underlying element is mental health, you know, and that's probably, sadly, what caused that guy to even find his way into your family's life in the first place. I'm sure if you reverse engineer his path, I'm sure there's trauma. Yeah. And it's just, you know, this multi-generational cycle doesn't stop. And the war on drugs, you know, started in the 1930s after the war on alcohol was a complete disaster, and they, you know, the prohibition was lifted. And yet there's still, and especially in law enforcement, as some of the hardest people that ask about this, you know, is when you spent 10, 20, 30 years enforcing drug laws, you know, and you look at the old 90s cops show where they have this fucking epic car chase, and then they whoop this guy's ass, and then he has like a little bit of, you know, weed in his pocket.
Yeah, and then he goes to prison for 20 years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, again, we get to question and go, look, this is not working. You know, should you arrest smugglers and dealers? Absolutely. That's a crime. That's profiting off addiction. But the addicts are probably most of what cause the crime that we see. And then the violence from fighting for territory to sell to the addicts are the things that we see as well. So yeah, I mean, questioning the legalizing addiction, you know, decriminalizing addiction, not selling. And there's also this misunderstanding that, oh, that means you're going to go to Publix and there'll be crack and meth and, you know, next to the baby formula. It's like, no, just when you interact with someone, that money is funneled into proactive measures where you get mental health care and addiction counseling. And there's places like Portugal and Switzerland and, you know, other places around the world that have done it with huge success. And I always say this with this defund conversation, with this George Floyd thing, it was all about you guys. It was all about, oh, these cops. Well, where's the conversation on that the streets of Finland aren't filled with gangbangers murdering each other? What are we doing wrong with that thing? I think that's the conversation that my profession, your profession, and everyone else needs to come together. Because when I ask people, especially now in 2022, people are starting to go, you know what? I think that's a good idea. So if we have the same energy and gusto behind changing the mental health crisis as they did behind bloody COVID, we would literally change the world.
Or if they had put up that much money into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Already, I mean, how many billions wouldn't... But in the COVID, with all the, you know, Pfizer and all that, I think, I mean, and you see the people that, like, I'm not really big on, you know, pharmaceuticals. I don't take any pills or anything. And it's the people that can't afford the pills. They ended up, you know, making their own drugs for the same effect. And like, that's where crack comes from. You know, it's just, okay, I can't get this because I need this. Doctor won't fill it, so I'm just gonna make it. And it's always a spiraling thing of you get addicted to pills and then you get addicted to drugs and then. So definitely, it's one of those things where you wonder if people and the government's not gonna help you like get better on your own. It's more like you gotta research yourself and do your own information as to, okay, why do I feel like this? Is there something I can do to change this? And like, even there's something you're talking about earlier, like sleep, like even just getting more sleep helps, you know, like, or just tracking your sleep. And like, there's times where when I was working night shift, I was running on 4 or 5 hours of sleep, and I'm like, this, your body feels worse. And there's research, your immune system is weakened with less amount of sleep you get. So like, the immune system's what you got, and you kind of need that to be as good as it can get for you. So like, now, like, I mean, my wife, she'll get eight or nine, and like, if I get, my body's still adjusting to getting more. If I get 7, it'll want to wake up at like 6, and like, I'll wake up at like 5 o'clock before the alarm goes off, and I'm like, damn it, I have one more hour.
Are you on days now then?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It takes a while. It's honestly, I'm not exaggerating. I did 14 years, and I want to say it took pretty much 3 years to reset.
Yeah, I believe
it. I'm just kind of getting there now, so.
I mean, even like now, like sometimes where it'll be 10 o'clock, and I'll be like, I could sit on my phone for like another hour before I'm like, all right, I should go to sleep, you know?
Well, yeah, I there's definitely some things I do now. Alcohol, I've actually talked about this for, you know, 5 years on this show about how I use alcohol as a, you know, a tool to unwind. And I'm very conscious of how unhealthy it was. And then I just had a 3-month abstinence. I had a couple of days because I had my birthday where I drank. And then I'm, you know, again, haven't since then. That's been huge. Like, not drinking alcohol for me. Blue blocking glasses before you go to bed. I put my damn phone in the other room so that I can't play with my phone for an hour before I go to bed. And it's amazing if you don't drink and you don't, I mean, I'll even, cause the blue blocking glasses allow me to watch a little TV. Cause I do find, you know, that helps kind of wind down. I think the blue blocking element stops you getting that stay awake stimulus. And yeah, I'm sleepy as hell by 10 o'clock now, but it takes diligent, like deliberate routines to tell your body, hey, it's okay to wind down. You know, you're not going to get a call.
I've been seeing like stuff about that, like the whole like keeping the phone away from the nightstand at night, and that's like, I'm horrible at that, and I need to start trying that, because like, I just sit there and look at it, and with beer, because like, I run half marathons, and like towards like, if I'm like a month out or a month or two out, I'll fast until then. And then this last one, I took like a month off break of running, and I like drinking craft beer, and those things are heavy.
They are.
So I started running again, and I'm like, oh man, like I'm about to have to like cut down on the beer again. And it's funny, the last time I ran a half marathon towards the end, the last like quarter of a mile, a doctor is like, he pulls up next to me, and like, we're like running and talking. And just picking his brain, because, you know, you got a guy that's like maybe like 60 years old and he's about to finish a half marathon the same time I'm about to. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, what am I doing wrong here, man? Let me ask you how you feel about certain things. And he's like, yeah, you got to stop drinking beer. And I was like all the time, you know? So that's definitely one thing where I'm like, okay, I can tell when the body goes like, all right, it feels good, but long-term gain is like, you know, you kind of got to space it out. And like going back when you're talking about like decompressing with it, there was a time when I was on nights and I was just worn out and, you know, dealing with shit at work and just being up. I come home and I find myself for like maybe a month straight, I'm like drinking a beer before I go to bed at like 7 a.m. And like, and that's two things. Like, it's not good to drink before you go to sleep. And then now you're on that night schedule, like you're drinking in the morning. And it's like, okay, like reassess, like we need to find something else, you know, because this can go down a path of, you know, bad body decisions. And next thing you know, you're an alcoholic.
Absolutely. Now with that, just I haven't visited this element yet. You had the acute trauma losing your mom. You had the, you know, the trauma really as a young man, your interaction with your dad then. Then you join a profession where you are sleep deprived, where you start seeing and having to do things that in themselves are traumatic. I don't know if you experienced this, but I had agencies where the biggest trauma was who you work for and some of the politics in that. On this whole journey, did you revisit counseling? Were there any tools that you found have helped you address what you've been through when you were younger?
So mainly with me and my wife, we did marriage counseling, and I found that helped. And it wasn't like, you know, like we're on the verge of divorce or anything. It was just like, okay, let's, you know, there's some issues. Let's see how we can fix these issues. And of course, all of my issues had to deal with my childhood with my dad and like how that affects my communication with people, you know, people that I love. So mainly, I think looking back, there was never anything like after what happened with my mom. There wasn't something that was holding me up from or giving me trauma with communication or anything like that, except my wife will tell you I got a hard time telling people I love them. Like her mom would say it the same by on the phone, and I'm like, I still can't say it. I'm like, all right. Like I can only tell my wife and my kid. But looking back, there was sometimes the counseling helped me learn my issues were just kind of just being my own man. And, you know, the counselor recommended, you know, making that olive branch to my dad. And I did that. There's three separate times, you know, like being an adult, I'm in law enforcement, I have a career, I have a kid, married, like I think I'm doing this right, you know. And there was one time when we're at my parents' house, and my wife took my daughter to the bathroom, and my dad was like, he was like, what's your daughter's name again? I'm like, okay, so you just don't care. Like, I can't waste my time on this anymore. So like, I've invested enough. I've tried, you know, like I'm fine with this. This is how it is. And I realized like life, I mean, especially having a kid, I feel like time moves faster, and there's times where it's like, I can't waste time on people that don't love me. Like, I can't waste my free time on that. And like, even now, like my daughter's 6, she's turning 8, you know, in 2 years. And I was thinking the other day, I'm like, can I imagine dying in 2 years? You know, cause that's when my mom died when I was 8. So, and it's like, you know, I feel like there's so much I haven't done yet in life. And it definitely, it's hitting me the older she's getting, you know, like I just want to make sure I can live a full life now. And, like my mom, I think she was in her 40s at the time. Like she'd be, yeah, she's turning 62 this year, I believe. Her birthday is this month. And I'm like thinking in my head, I'm like, can you just imagine dying at 40 or even dying at 60? And, you know, there's so many people that you see on TV that, you grew up always watching, and it's like, man, that guy, he's 84, like, he's 70, like, you know, like, how old is Morgan Freeman, you know?
Oh, he's old.
Yeah, like, he was
awesome and old.
Like, he was always old since I remember, and it's just one of those things where it's like, do what you can mentally, physically, to like get to that point, you know? Like, I got a little CrossFit gym stuff in the garage, you know, that functional fitness, you know, I believe in that. That helps. Like, the weight I'm at now, you know, if I could cut down probably like 20 pounds, I'd feel better. Like, I can move at this weight, but I'm like, all right, let me cut down, you know, because I don't want any knee issues, joint issues when I get older. I just want to be able to do my time in law enforcement. You know, if I do something else, you know, I'll have my whole body that I can relax and enjoy life and not have to worry about my kid having to push me around or be stuck in a hospital, you know?
Well, I think that's a big conversation that wasn't had as well. And sadly, this kind of fat shaming element has factored into this, where rather than the message, which I truly believe most people want other people to be healthy out of kindness and compassion. In fact, true fat shaming is just a horrible person. And that could be racism, prejudice, you know, whatever. That's just a turd, you know, spitting out hate. But the concern for the health of the nation comes from a place of kindness. Firstly, you know, when you are in good shape, you're like, dude, this is what the human body can do. And I'm, you know, like, for me, I'm in average shape. I'm a good version, I guess, of me, but you watch gymnasts and martial artists and, you know, all these phenomenal people, and like, my God, the human body can do incredible things. And like you said, you're 50-year-olds, you know, wheeling around in electric wheelchairs for no other reason than their weight. But that's the other side of the conversation, is like, as a person, if you don't choose to take care of yourself, you're choosing to be a burden to your family. You're choosing to be a burden to your community and your country. And then even sadly, you become a statistic in things like a pandemic, where it should have only had a much smaller death toll, now wiped out loads of Americans. And, you know, that's, no matter what anyone wants to say, you know, 90%+ were chronically ill before it happened. There's always anomalies. I've had people that were young and fit drop dead from aneurysms and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Was there any rhyme and reason to it? No, it happens. But most people, you know, it was their health. And you wanted to prevent what happened to you and your family from happening again, and it sent you to a law enforcement. I want to prevent the death and disease I've seen as a paramedic in the people I run on and in my peers. And that's why I started this podcast. And so I agree with you completely. Like, if you don't want to do it for yourself, do it for someone else. Do it for the people that you love. Yeah. Because otherwise, as you said it perfectly, I don't want my kids to be pushing me around in a wheelchair either, you know? And if it happens, like I get hit by a bus, then it is what it is. But that was kind of out of my control. But the things that I can control, I don't want to be a burden to my family.
Yeah. I just saw something on the internet the other day, and it was like, the saying where people say, you know, I'd die for my kids. And I was like, will you live for them? You know, like, because so that's kind of where I'm at with that. Like, having her really kind of changed my perspective on certain things. Like, even when she was a baby, you know, I was working in Cocoa, and I'd still, like, I wouldn't care about making it home. I would just care about, you know, wanting to chase bad guys and do all that and have fun. And then she started getting older, and then I find myself, I'm telling drug dealers and gang members at work, I'm like, listen, like, I'm going home. Whatever you do, my wife is expecting me to go to Disney Monday. Like, I got annual passes. I'm going home. If I got to kill you, I got to kill you. I'm going home, you know? And it definitely, like, having the family it turned into that why. Like, what is your why? And I wouldn't be here without that, so...
Absolutely. Well, I want to go one more area and then we'll go to some closing questions. But this last year, you know, you had the whole defund movement. You had some legitimate errors by people in uniform that, again, took innocent family members from families. And I totally understand, you know, why those people were devastated. But then that was tagged on to, you know, so much anti-police rhetoric. Obviously, the the actual concept of defunding. You and I know it's like defunding the fire department. We've already got fire stations closed down. You just want no one to be there to respond. But with the solution of all this, like coming from what you've been through, whether it's community policing, how do we repair the damage that was the media shitstorm that followed some of those incidences the last couple of years?
I mean, just time. You know, you're seeing history kind of repeat itself, where you know Minneapolis is now throwing hundreds of millions back into its law enforcement. So you just, the media really, they got what they wanted. They got division. I think once you realize that we're all just trying to work together, that'll help kind of get us. And I don't know if there was how it was in the past. It won't be better than in the future. We can always make improvements, you know, and that's kind of the point of learning new information. So hopefully in the future, you know, we can start mending those relationships. And I know, like, for me personally, my wife's mom's friend, like a longtime family friend, he's a teacher, and every year I speak to his career development class in high school, and I talk to kids, and it's like, hey, like, just because this traumatic incident happened to you doesn't mean that you have to be negative, or you have to, you know, hey, fuck cops. You don't have to do all that and choose to not be a contributing member to society. Like, you can have something bad happen to you, and you can find some way to make it help somebody else or help other people. And so I gotta tell them, like, make your mess your message, you know? And it's definitely, I don't know how many kids are out, you know, doing whatever, but I know there's times where the teacher, he gets back to me and he'll call me. I'm doing it again in 2 weeks, and he'll tell me, you know, there's some kids that it really impacted them. And sometimes there was one kid last time, he didn't believe me that I told him, you know, what happened with my mom. And I'm like, you can Google it, man, if you don't believe me, if you want to sit here and, you know, act like a class clown. But I'm just trying to, like, I feel like at least my purpose, you know, I wasn't just, we're all put on this earth for something. And I feel like if I could help somebody get through whatever they're going through, you know, have them get out of that hole. Because there was a time where, you know, I blamed myself for a little bit. And, you know, when you're young, you shouldn't do that. I couldn't control that variable. I wouldn't have, like, okay, if the garage door was closed, what if he just jumped through a window, you know? So it's definitely, like, between that and then I tell them, like, something I couldn't control was that. Something I could have controlled, that I made a bad decision, was when I was 18, now my bullshit. Both of those happened. Both of them could have easily been a reason enough to say, you know, fuck cops, fuck whatever, and just go about, be a piece of shit. But I chose not to, you know? And I think the main reason why I choose not to is because I wasn't living for me. I had other people dependent on me. Like, I got them dependent on me, you know? So you can't be selfish with your life. You only got one.
Absolutely. Well, it reminds me as well of the message itself, you know, not being defined by your trauma. And I just had Danny Boy O'Connor, who's one of the House of Pain members.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was like, how am I supposed to follow that up? like, no pressure here.
Yeah, exactly, because you literally are following him. He's going to be, today's actually. But it's so interesting because he said, you know, their own lyrics, and obviously a lot of hip hop, and I'm a huge hip hop fan even to this day, even though I tend to gravitate still towards the 90s stuff. You know, it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy if it's all fuck the police. And, you know, the irony I point out all the time is, like, Ice Cube and Ice-T, you know, fuck the police and Cop Killer.
And now they're always on cops.
Exactly. Making cops. Millions, yeah. Portraying cops. Where's the, hey, by the way, youth of today, this is what I was thinking then. This is what I've actually learned. These are all these great, you know, there's none of that, which is terrible. But yeah, I mean, if the more we paint this division, and as you and I know, those are the extremities again. Those are the extremes. Yeah. You know, the ones who truly are in uniform and are bad people, and the ones that truly are out there gangbanging, is both slivers of society. And the rest of us people, normal people, are in the middle. But the more we allow that message to be portrayed, the deeper that division becomes. So I think, you know, hearing your story is why I think it's so important. Just, it's just one of, you know, millions and millions of stories where people have tragedy and it didn't define them. In your case, I mean, you could fucking drop right into the narrative of the last 2 years and be standing next to Al and his fucked up haircut yeah. talking about, you know,
yeah.
race and, you know, racism in 2022. And yeah, there's racism in bigoted, probably mentally, you know, traumatized people that have allowed themselves to buy into that. But we need to hear you. We need yeah. to hear the Knicks of the world, you know, showing that most people are incredible people and that you don't have to be defined by your trauma. And no matter your color, creed, whatever, you can be whatever you fucking want to be in this world. You forge your own path. And hopefully the mentors of the world will unite and raise these young men and women up and empower them and show them, look, you know, yeah, you were born here and you and I have seen these houses where you're like, how the hell are these kids ever going to get out? But then you have people like, I had Steve O. Michelle, who was born in Timberscan. If anyone in the Orlando area knows where Timberscan is, it's, I mean, almost apocalyptic. These poor people living in this little apartment complex. And he ended up getting a scholarship, going to the University of Colorado. I think I got that right. It was in Colorado, whichever the college was. And then went back to Orange County and became a firefighter and worked in his first year protecting Timberscan and inspiring all the young kids. Look, this yeah. is what I did. So I love these stories.
Yeah, definitely, man. When I tell people in America, I mean, you can be whatever you want to be here. If you want to be successful, you can be successful. If you want to be oppressed, you can be oppressed. You know, it's your mindset. So if you want to sit there and blame, you know, other people, go ahead. But no one's going to, you know, no one's going to help you help yourself. And like what happened with my family, man, is definitely when I first got into law enforcement, the older guys, they knew about it and they saw me. They're like, dude, like, I know who you are. I'm like, what? Like all the older SWAT guys, they would, a friend of mine, he actually gave me a book. It's like a sniper training book, and it has like all these different incidents involving SWAT snipers, and there's a section of it of, you know, what happened in that book, and I'm like, wow. And even now, like the people I met along the way just doing this, just being here, I had a training one time and I met the instructor. He says, hey, I used to work in Orlando around this time, and I was like, well, on a break, I was like, hey, you remember this situation? He was like, I was on that call out, and he was actually the sniper scout on the call out. He ended up leaving the sniper's post, and he heard the shot go off, and then they realized they shot the wrong person. And when I say everything happens for a reason, like what I expect, you know, 20 something plus years later, that this guy's teaching me in a cop class, you know, we grabbed lunch, we talked about God, and you know, I have his number, we keep in touch. He just retired the other day, so I had to call him. I was like, hey, congrats, you know, you made it. And it's definitely one of those things where, like, it's anything can happen, you know, and everything happens for a reason. So if I can help somebody just by, you know, saying my story, you know, hopefully help somebody go, hey, just because I'm going through this doesn't mean I have to, you know, go down this path. I can get out and I can help change somebody.
Absolutely. Now, did you ever get to talk to the sniper himself with you being in law enforcement?
I've met some people, you know, I asked about them. I haven't talked to them. I know at this point, that's probably going to be something in my next chapter of life is talking to him mm-hmm. and just let them know. Because, I mean, I can only imagine whatever he went through, you know, like mentally back then. You know, I was angry. I'm at peace. You know, I forgive him. Everything happens for a reason. And I think he's retired, last side I heard. But I don't know where he's at. But I feel like that conversation is probably going to happen.
Well, let's hope he listens to this.
Yeah.
That'll be amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, it's been an amazing conversation. I want to just throw some closing questions at you before we kind of wrap up. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion or completely unrelated.
So right now, what I'm listening to is an audiobook. It's Joe DeSena, and it's his latest one. It's about like parenting. Like him and Jocko Willink, man, those two, which I saw you had him on the podcast, I think, right?
Yes, yeah a couple times.
Yeah. His book with the leadership.
Extreme Ownership.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That one, then the second one he did after that was I listened to, and it kind of helped me. It helped me learn how to deal with certain supervisors at work, and like knowing, because like right now, I mean, I'm an agent right now, and eventually I'll be a supervisor, and it was like kind of life skills to help you handle conflict. And there was one time where I had a sergeant that it was rough, and I was like, all right, I need to figure this out, like how to deal with this. And those two, like their mindsets really kind of helping me be a better person, you know?
Brilliant. So, yeah, I had Joe on the show as well.
Oh, really?
Joe, the founder of Spartan. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy's crazy. Yep. But like,
yeah, no, that's brilliant to hear. And it's funny because I went to the Extreme Ownership, well, the Echelon Front muster late last year, I think it was. And they did role-playing of basically bad supervisors. And it was... You know, of course, it's easier said than done when you're just, you know, acting it. But, you know, there were some really interesting twists of where you put it back on yourself, where, you know, because, I mean, sadly, a lot of the bad leadership really revolves around ego. So it's not kissing ass, but it was putting it in a way where, you know, you leave that supervisor feeling somewhat empowered, but you've kind of also turned them to the point where you've, you know, overcome whatever obstacle it was, whether you're asking for something or because I mean, the reality is, I talk about this a lot, not only is that a real thing in our profession that, you know, creates a lot of undue stress in an already stressful career, but it's actually a result, you know, results in a lot of mental health challenges too. So it's a, you know, an issue that needs to be resolved on a lot of layers.
Yeah, half of this job is who you work for.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. Well, the next question, what about a movie and or documentary? You talked about your wife, you know, exposing you to a lot of them.
Well, she's big on any Netflix serial killer documentary. I know, movies, and it takes us a while to like watch anything new. Like she doesn't like Star Wars, so it took me years to watch Star Wars by myself the last like three episodes. But I'd say probably my favorite ones are the Christian Bale Batman movies. I like those.
Brilliant. All right, well, next question, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
I mean, the only name I'm thinking of is my boy Doug.
Yeah.
Doug Monda.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if, has he been on the show yet?
He has. We're actually going to do another one. But Doug Monda is the man behind Trauma Behind the Badge.
Yeah.
And amazing, amazing human. He's been on once, but we're actually talking about doing another one. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, thank you to Doug for connecting us, by the way. Shout out to him. All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure people know where to find you, if you want them to find you, what do you do to decompress?
What I do to decompress? I mean, you see it over here. I got a garden that we're doing now. It used to be hunting, kind of taking some time off from hunting. And that was just really, it turned into, I like to run, you know, work out and garden. And fish. I've been trying to get back into fishing. My daughter thinks I don't know how to catch a fish. A while back, she was like, she asked my father-in-law, she's like, Papa, does daddy know how to fish? I've never seen him catch a fish. So I was like, okay, we need to start fishing again.
Now, what kind of fishing do you like? We were talking about it before we start recording.
Yeah, surf fishing. I like just chilling on the beach, you know, throw some bait out and relax and enjoy the sun.
See, I thought I discovered some awesome, like, extreme way of fishing where you're standing on a surfboard with a rod in your hand. But then I realized it's what we call beach casting in the UK.
I think people do that, though. When you shark fish, they'll go out on, like, a paddleboard, throw that line out, and then come back in. But Yeah, not me.
Beautiful. All right. Well, then if people do want to either learn more about you, reach out to you, where are the best places? I know, obviously, in law enforcement, you're not going to be all over everywhere, yeah. But what's the best avenue?
Email or social media. I mean, my Instagram's Nick97Colt. So that's, it's old, and that's same as my email address, Nick97Colt@Hotmail.
Okay. Beautiful. Well, Nick, I just want to say thank you. Like, it's been such an amazing conversation when Doug first told me about you and your story. And not that you're like, oh, this would be a great scoop, like some cheesy journalist, but just this is a conversation that people need to hear. And to, you know, to go from, you know, what happened to your family, and obviously what really happened to your family was someone came into your life that should never have been there. And then that created the other circumstance. But to have walked through now and, you know, you've got this beautiful family and to have what happened with your father experience. And now here you are, a loving dad, you know, of a beautiful little girl. You know, it's been such an incredible conversation. So I just want to say thank you so much for telling your story today.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you listening.